Hey folks, Tony and I are really excited to continue our partnership with Ruiz Auto Services, All American Used Cars and Trucks. We got some great new specials here for Ruiz Auto, located at just south of 90th and Fort here in Omaha, 4839 North 90th Street. Just talked to Esmeralda the other night, and here's what we got for the next couple of months here. Saturdays, if you are looking for a free inspection and check on your air conditioning, all you have to do is say a pen and a napkin sent you in, and the crew at Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust will check your air conditioning. They will inspect it, and it will be for free. Also, on Saturdays, while you're there, you need an oil change, right? Just it's a Saturday ritual, especially in the summertime. Go in and get your oil change. If you mention a pen and a napkin, it'll be $50 for your oil change, start to finish there at Ruiz. If you're in the market for a new set of tires, mention a pen and a napkin here over the next month or two, and the crew at Ruiz will give you a free mounting and balancing on your new set of four tires. That's a great deal, because that's probably, gosh, that's got to be a good $100 at least for the mounting and the balancing on the new tires. Just mention a pen and a napkin, and they're going to give that to you. So Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, All American Used Cars and Trucks, Esmeralda and Juan Carlos have been terrific to a pen and a napkin. They want to be terrific for you as well. They do great work, and I think you should check them out. So please go check out Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust. If you're in the market for a used car, All American Used Cars and Trucks. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Blum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, episode number 135, and I am, of course, with my co-host, Mr. Tony Devis, the proud owner of a new souped-up mower that has all four wheels on it. He is primed and ready to go. Folks in the Cedar Valley, if you need somebody to come over and take care of your lawn, Mr. Viss is your guy. Tony, how you doing this morning, my friend?
I'm doing well. I think we were talking earlier about the fact it used to take me about 45 minutes to mow my yard. My yard's not that big. And then after getting my lawnmower repaired by my neighbor guy here, I mowed it in 25 minutes. So I'm like, I don't know, like a little kid on Christmas Eve.
You are blessed beyond measure, my friend. So, and Tony's already got his lawn mowed. We're taping this Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, and Tony's already got his lawn mowed. He is Superman compared to me. I will be mowing my lawn after the pod.
I might not be the most popular guy in my neighborhood right now. I'll just put it that way.
You were up at 4 waiting for the newspaper to be delivered.
Come on, kid.
Where are you? I gotta know what the Cubs score was last night. they're kind of losing some traction here. So
we need a trade or two.
Yeah. We're about at the halfway point. You start figuring out what you got at this point. So, episode 135, favorite coaching books. Tony and I are going to break down some of our favorite books. If you're a loyal listener to A Pen and a Napkin, you know that I am a book nerd. I've got my stack of books that I've read so far this summer behind me right now, and I haven't brought them back up to school where I keep all my books. So I will be adding to that collection hopefully in the next few weeks. It's been kind of a crazy couple, 2-3 weeks here, so I haven't got as much reading time in as I would like. But that's going to pick up here. I'm going to find some nerd time for myself here. So,
if you aren't trying to be a cross-country trucker in your spare time, you might have a little bit of time to read.
Yeah.
I will sell you this. If you're going to continue to spend 20-plus hours behind the wheel, you might want to do some books on tape.
Well, I've got some podcasts on the phone that I do listen to there. So, and this was a good week. If I was going to spend 20 hours in a car this week, it was a good week with the finals, the last of the finals coverage, of kind of evaluating Oklahoma City, and then which that was just Sunday. which it's crazy, Tony. It seems like it was a month ago, but it was just Sunday. But had that, had and we'll get to this in our TWIB segment, the Durant trade, the
draft.
The draft. Yeah, so there's a whole there was more than enough material to keep me occupied as I was covering mileage in Nebraska and Iowa this week. So basketball history, Tony. 1951 NBA champs. Would you like to garner a guess as to who that was?
Let's go with the Omaha Royals.
You got the nickname right.
Really?
Yes.
I'm just making things up.
No. The Rochester Royals.
Oh,
yeah.
I must have missed that move.
Yes. Well, it was one of their many moves. 1951 NBA champions, Rochester Royals. They beat the New York Knickerbockers 4-3. Their best player, Arnie Raisin. They also had Ed Mikan, who was George Mikan's brother, on the roster. And their point guard was a guy by the name of Red Holtzman, who a couple of decades later would go down as the legendary head coach of the New York Knicks.
New York.
Yes. So this is the franchise that went from Rochester to, I believe, Cincinnati to Kansas City, then Kansas City, Omaha, and then back to Kansas City, and now in Sacramento. It is the last NBA championship for what we now call the Sacramento Kings. This is the longest drought in NBA. They are the Chicago Cubs of the NBA, Tony. It's been, I think it was 74 years. I had a trivia question a few weeks ago, and I was looking that up. 74 years since their last championship. So that's there. So any guesses, 1951 NCAA champions, Tony?
We've been talking about how Adolph Rupp and Kentucky's been dominating that time, but let's go with the Texas Western, also known as UTEP.
You should have stuck with your first guess.
Kentucky?
It was Kentucky, yes. They defeated Kansas State 68-58. It's their third championship in 4 years. And fun fact for you, it the final game, was played in McWilliams Arena in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the barn where the Gophers still play today. The Gophers, you know.
I heard you can get nest up there. You can see some outside. So, yeah, they might need a new arena.
Yeah. I can't understand why. I mean, in defense of Gopher fans, and then I have more than a few followers from the land of 10,000 lakes. I get the whole you want to have the history. I love old stadiums, old ball fields. I love going to Wrigley. Fenway Park was, as much of a Cubs fan as I am, Fenway Park was so awesome. But you also have to keep it modern, you know, and I think that is where the University of Minnesota is lacking in their facilities. And that's why their basketball program, both on the men's and women's side, continues to struggle, is because of their lack of facilities in that vein. I mean, I get it. You don't want to give up the old barn, literally. But you got to make the old barn kind of look like a new barn if you want people to come there. Just my opinion, but what do I know?
Yeah, makes sense. It's a race of facilities, and if you have the nicest facility, you usually get some pretty good players to back it up.
Yes, you do. So, Tony, we're both book nerds. We both love to read. We are going to talk about some of our favorite coaching books. I've got 7 of my favorites. One of the things that I have in Hoops 365, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO, is I have about 12 of my favorite coaching books listed in the book itself as recommendations to read. And I think quite a few of these, if not all of these, are in Hoops 365. So I think reading is important. If you are going to be a coach, I think you have to have that background. I think you have to have that ability to be able to parse through that information, to be able to put it. I don't think you can do everything via YouTube or tweets or Facebook or any of that type of stuff. To me, I still think there is a place for reading good books that are going to help educate you to become a better coach.
100% agree with that. I think a lot of times, you know, with our attention span, it's maybe that microwave mentality, want to be done quick and different things like that. And there are a lot of different things to keep in mind with reading. It doesn't have to be you physically reading a book can be, like I mentioned earlier, listening to it on tape, get a Kindle, whatever the case may be. And you don't have to read like these novels or anything like that. You can find books that are 100 pages long or 125 pages long that can be very, very beneficial to you. But I 100% agree. If you want your players to get better, you as a coach have to get better. And one of those things that's going to help you is to be a lifelong learner and to put time into reading some books.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, I'm very fortunate. I had parents that emphasized reading. And the first book that I'll start with, Tony, is perhaps the first real coaching book that I read. And at the time when I got into coaching, this was probably the most popular coach at the time. Other, probably him and Phil Jackson. And that is Rick Pitino. Now, I get it where some people may look at him and some of his personal failures that he had or that he was perceived to have, especially when he was at Louisville. I understand where people may say that's not the right person to emulate or to take some things from. And I get that's your personal choice. For me, I see Rick Pitino as a basketball genius, and I think he is one of the most motivating, smartest coaches there is in the world. And I think he's proved that again at St. John's and what he's done there in a very, very short amount of time. And so one of the first basketball books that I read was Success is a Choice. And it will always be one of the most influential books that I read because of that, because it's the first, that I really clearly remember like, oh, this speaks to me. This speaks to me in a way that I feel like I understand what he's trying to help me to do. And so it's 10 chapters. There's 10 parts to it. A lot of self-esteem, setting demanding goals, to be positive, establishing good habits, which was really important for me. So, things like organizing your day, don't procrastinate, get in shape, maintain a good physical appearance. Fifth part is mastering the art of communication. Sixth part, learning from role models, speaking of which, thriving under pressure, being persistent. I still use this phrase, PhD, that Pitino talked about in the book, poor, hungry, and driven. That's what you want for your assistant coaches. You want them to be poor, hungry, and driven. Learning from adversity, which kind of prophetic that 20 plus years later, Pitino was going to go through all sorts of adversity on a personal level, and then surviving success. Once you achieve success, how do you survive it? How do you continue to get better as you are finally kind of climbing to the top of the mountain there? So success is a choice. I will always say it had such an influence on my coaching career. Again, in large part because it was the first leadership/coaching book that I read that I was like, this really speaks to me. This guy understands what I want to do with my life. And it just nailed it for me.
It was a great book. I did not put it in my five, but it is one that I remember. I also remember he put out a DVD, I'm sorry, a VHS, that's how old I am. But anyway, VHS on post play, and was just amazed with what he knew about post play in terms of positioning and all the details and stuff like that. But like you said, there are some shortcomings in his life as far as his personal life goes. But if you're talking about a Mount Rushmore of coaches, I think he's got to be up there. We're not trying to select him as a priest or a pastor or anything like that. We're talking about a basketball coach. And you take a look where he's won. He's won everywhere. Providence, Iona, St. John's, Louisville, Kentucky. He had success in the NBA. His share of failure in the NBA as well. But the other thing I'll give you as well, he also went over to Europe and won.
Yeah.
But everywhere he goes, he wins. And, like you said, with St. John's was a mess. And you bring him in and they were a one seed and had all kinds of success and, didn't end the way that they wanted it to. But just a great basketball coach. I would echo that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you watch both tonight?
I was just going to say, did you watch that Red Storm or whatever they had on Vice?
I did not catch in much of that. I saw a viral clip one time where he was talking and I was ready to run through a brick wall. But yeah. I didn't catch much of it. But yeah, he's phenomenal.
Yeah. All right. Sorry. What's your first one, buddy?
The one that probably has had the most impact on me is a book by Todd Gongwer, who I don't know if you've heard of him before, but it's called Lead for God's Sake. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of like the books that I enjoy, and I think you'll kind of pick up on this a little bit. They got stories in them. And this one was basically talking about leadership. And basically, it's about this janitor who's at this school who kind of mentors this coach and his players. And it was just a very, very powerful book. And I remember it was so good, I wanted to do a book study with my team with it. And so I was like, I don't know. I better run this past my AD. And I had my AD at the time read it. He texted me the next morning. He's like, "You jerk." I'm like, "Oh, great." Didn't like it. He goes, "I couldn't put the thing down." So he stayed up late, finished the entire book in one sitting. But yeah, it just was really, really good. Had a tremendous impact on me just in terms of how to treat people, how to lead, how to approach it. I mean, there's all kinds of people. Monty Williams, head coach for the New Orleans Hornets. He came in and wrote a little thing on it as well. Urban Meyer mentions it, but it is one that I don't know how many people know about it, but it is a phenomenal book. Again, about this janitor, very humble. You don't know a whole lot about his background, but this coach who's going through some stuff, has some high expectations, some setbacks with his team and different things, and how he shows him how to humbly, with poise and composure, navigate those situations. And it just was really a very, very powerful book. You know, basically it helped to answer why I do what I do and what my purpose in leadership is. And so just, it was a great book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's got a John Gordon vibe to it, kind of a parable type of a deal.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I enjoy those, you know, Energy Bus is a great example of that. We would, when I was at Fort Calhoun, we did Energy Bus. Soup. What were the other two that we did? I can't think what they were. But I
did a hard hat.
No, we didn't do a hard hat. They were all parables. The one with the sticks. It's really short. It took hardly any time to read.
Stick together.
Yes. And then I can't remember what the carpenter. The carpenter was the fourth one that we did. So yeah, those parable and when you're doing that as a team book study, those books are really good because it's a story. It's not a bullet point type of a thing. And the best thing is for your players, it should be easy for them to understand and hopefully be able to put it all together.
Yes. And you know, sometimes you'll get the five whatever to do this, and it's like, man, I don't know if I can pack all five of those things in there, the four, whatever, you know. And then with a story, I don't know, those parable type things just really, really stick to me. But I can remember what the story is. I might not remember all five laws or all five standards or the three rules or whatever, but I can tell you the story.
Mm-hmm. Youth sports today has become a billion-dollar industry nationwide, and grassroots basketball has been at the epicenter of this explosion. These days, players, parents, and handlers chase the almighty scholarship, NIL deals, and branding creation. However, there is still one place where basketball coaches and players come to develop their games without the fanfare and adulation of recruiting gurus, next-level evaluations, and social media highlight reels. It's not a basketball camp. It's a basketball school. Snow Valley Basketball School started as the brainchild of Herb Livesey, who, as a young adult, was inspired by the great Bob Cousy to start his own basketball camp. Starting in 1961 at Snow Valley Ski Resort, east of Los Angeles, before moving to Westmont College in Santa Barbara, Livesey's school was a place for the game's greatest coaches to teach the game throughout the 1970s and 80s. Two Iowans, Don Showalter and Jerry Slykus, adopted Livesey's curriculum, bringing the school to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa in 1994. This summer will be a celebration of its 30th anniversary of Snow Valley in the Hawkeye State. Here, over 1,400 campers will start each day before dawn and end after the sun goes down. Snow Valley Basketball School is America's longest continuously running basketball camp. It's where players come to learn and coaches come to teach. For those that come there every summer, it is the home to the last of the Cowboys. The Last of the Cowboys, the story of Snow Valley Basketball School, will be available on Amazon on July 1st, 2025. Paperback copies will be available for $17.99, while Kindle copies will be available for pre-order for $9.99. Get to know the story of America's longest continuous basketball camp. My next one, Tony, is the Coach's Guide to Teach. I'm going to jam two of these together. I really like Doug Lamov. He brings education into a practical sense, kind of like you're talking about with the parables and taking these stories of leadership or these words of wisdom about leadership, but they put it in an entertaining form. And I really like the way Doug Lamov takes his stuff and puts it into a practical way of applying it, whether it's for teaching or coaching. And so I'm going to take two and put it into one, the Coach's Guide to Teaching and then Practice Perfect. I really just, again, we're talking about books that speak to us, the power of practice, rethinking practice. For example, in practice, you are meant to screw up. I mean, part of practice is screwing up, to push yourself, to find different ways of doing things, how to practice, how to isolate things, to name it, to make a plan, to model your behaviors. This is all from Practice Perfect. How do you give feedback, shortening the feedback loop, the culture of your practice, all of these things. And a lot of this is built towards the classroom, but obviously it's all about the gymnasium or the football field or the tennis court or wherever it may be. Like, you know, rule number 31, normalize error. That's what you want. Breaking down barriers. And so anything by Doug Lamov, I suck it up. I think he's really, really good at what he does because he puts it in a practical sense that you can apply to your teaching or your coaching situation. So I'm going to take two of my seven and put it into one there. Those are two that I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah, Doug Lamov, I read Practice Perfect as well. And like you said, the big thing that I took away from it also was the fact that practice should be a place where you mess up. And, you know, it's not a place where you want to demand that they, you know, they're so rigid and they can't make mistakes, because that's where you want to try to, you know, break some things out and push yourself to a point. And so that was a really good book as well. I'm going to take and put three of mine together because they're all John Gordon books. Okay. You mentioned the Energy Bus earlier. I like that one a lot. That's one, you know, with the energy vampires and, you know, having kids find to be positive and stuff. And I'm reading another book right now. I usually do a book study in the summer with one of my friends. Patrick Corey is his name. He's the trap shooting coach at Co. And so we're reading a book right now, and it has a lot of those same things in there from the Energy Bus with no vampires and positivity. And the positivity is truly an advantage. And she shared some numbers as I was reading through one of the chapters yesterday that were just unbelievable in terms of just being positive, how that is truly a tremendous advantage from a competition standpoint. But I love the Energy Bus by John Gordon. I know you mentioned a few others earlier as you were sitting there. I got Stick Together up on my shelf, The Carpenter. But two that others that I would throw along with the Energy Bus that are also great books by John Gordon. Hard Hat. I don't know if you've ever heard of that one before.
Read one. But it's 21 I read ways, that one. Yep.
Yeah, 21 Ways to Be a Great Teammate, and about his teammate who actually got killed on the lacrosse field, hit in the chest and different things like that. And then goes through and talks about this guy's story and what a powerful story it is. And so would definitely recommend that. And if I remember correctly, Marty, and you might want to look this up and Google it, but I think that Cornell won the national championship in lacrosse this year, if I remember correctly.
21 years after he died.
Yeah, and yeah. It's 21 Ways to Be a Great Teammate. So kind of that symmetry, if you will. Mm-hmm. Another one that's really good by John Gordon is Training Camp.
Yep.
And if I remember correctly, I think in this one, it's kind of a story about Maurice Jones-Drew, if I remember right. But that's also another really, really good book by him. But Energy Bus, Hard Hat, and The Training Camp are three by John Gordon that I cannot recommend enough. Those are all three really good books to take the time to read through.
Yeah, it's hard to go wrong with anything with John Gordon. And he's got enough variety now in his library that if you need something short and sweet, like Stick Together, You've got that. If you want something more detailed, you've got the Energy Bus or the Carpenter or Training Camp. It's so another John Gordon one that I really like is You Win the Locker Room First. That's another really, really good one by him as well. So I really, you know, again, you can't go wrong. You just can't go wrong with any John Gordon type of stuff. So what's the one that you and Patrick are reading? Positivity is Truly an Advantage. Is that the name of it, Tony?
No, it's basically what you're looking at with that one. It's Champion's Creed. There we go. Because we screwed up because we were going to read The Champion's Creed. And so I was having Rita look it up on Kindle to see if she could find it. And we got Champion's Creed instead. But it's been a really good book. And then we're going to go back and read The Champion's Creed by Ben Utek. That'll be our second book that we'll do this summer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My next one is Atomic Habits by James Clear. Have you read that one, Tony?
I have. That's another really good one as well.
Yeah. It's, again, really just self-evaluation, just building really, really good habits. And for me, if folks can't pick up on things, I'm far from perfect. And I definitely have some bad habits. I'll be the first one to admit that. But when you're talking about being the best that you can be, it all starts with building great habits. And if you don't have that day-to-day habit schedule, if you will, you know, you have those habitual things that you do on a daily basis or that you don't do on a daily basis, you're never going to reach your maximum capabilities. You're never going to max out on your potential. And so I'm always fascinated by the habits that you have, how do you do things? You know, we're given certain talents, and there's certain talents that we can make better, but I'm never going to have as amazed as you may be by the following statement, Tony. I will never have the vertical leap that LeBron James has. No matter how many plyometrics that I do, I'm just not going to get there. But
what about the jump shoes?
Yeah, I could get the Kramer plyo shoes. But I can build the best habits to be the best me that I can be. And I know in my 28 years, as I grew and grew as a coach, as I became more seasoned and experienced, I know my habits as a coach were about as good as they possibly could be. And a lot of that came from that, you know, and one of the big things that I took from Atomic Habits, he talked, and this is another one that kind of stuck with me, kind of like with Patino's PhDs, Poor, Hungry, and Driven, be 1% better every day. Be 1% better every day. And when we were trying to get things going in the right direction at Fort Calhoun, my kids, if they had a nickel for every time they heard that 1% better, they'd be very rich by now. We would emphasize that every single day. Let's just be 1% better today. Let's just continue to get 1% better. And that's, I got that directly from Atomic Habits. And so that's another really, really good one for me.
Yes. Patrick and I also PLC together. And one of the things that we do is we'll do a book study with PLC. And so that's where we came across Atomic Habits. And he had read it before. So it was really good for him to share that with me. Earlier, you mentioned a coach that maybe had some moral failings, but was a great coach. And a book that I've also read with a coach that has some moral failings, but a great coach, Urban Meyer's Above the Line. I don't know if you've read that one before, but that one is a really, really good book. And just talking about how oftentimes we'll settle for mediocrity or we'll even drop down further than that. And he just keeps talking about making sure the fact that from a standpoint of ethics and moral code and effort and so on and so forth, you're above that line. And so that one was really, really good. I enjoyed that book a lot.
E plus R equals O.
There you go.
Yeah. I believe that's where that came from. What is it? Event plus
response equals outcome.
Yes. That's what it is. So that's, So Tony, my next one would be All In by Porter Mosier. Obviously, he became a household name when he took Loyola to the Final Four. Was about 8-9 years ago now. But now he's at Oklahoma, and he wrote a book, and it's not very long. It's maybe 150 pages, but there it's just chock full of really, really good coaching information. Talking about how he does things, how he develops his players. And I really, really liked it. It's something that I referenced in the 365 book. So I highly recommend Porter Moser's All In. I really enjoyed that one as well.
I have not read that one, so I may have to grab that at some point. All In by Porter Moser.
Yep.
I'll go next with speaking of coaches that have had great impact. Mike Krzyzewski's 5-Point Play. I don't know if you've ever read that one before.
Yep.
But that one was really, really good. To this day, I read this. Oh man, it's got to be so many told me here 25 plus years ago. But to this day, before we leave the huddle to come out of the timeout or whatever, we put a fist in there. And if you know anything about 5-Point Play, the fist is big because that's the strongest point that your hand is when it's in the shape of a fist. And so we'll put that in there together and whatever we say when we go out, family, team, whatever. But that's a big part. The collective responsibility is a part of that as well. But just a book that really, really had a lot of good things and just was really, really good to read. The 5-Point Play, I cannot recommend that one enough.
Yeah, anything by Kay is usually pretty good stuff. The Gold Standard, I think that's what it's called, The Gold Standard. And our mutual friend, Coach Showalter, he talks a lot on, you know, what are the gold standards of USA basketball? And that's something that Coach Kay and Jerry Colangelo work together on. So anything that you're living through in that way, I think is really, really good stuff. So the gold standards, like you said, that's a good one. Or like I said, I think that's a good one. 5-Point Plan, obviously very, very good. So yeah, you win 1,300 games and 5 national championships and 3 or 4 gold medals, you're going to, excuse me, God, I am a mess right now, Tony. It's going to be good stuff. So,
And the thing about this one that really spoke to me was, you know, they lost Carlos Boozer and then they basically completely redid how they were playing. And he just talked that they had to have great trust in him and that they would win the national championship. And, you know, I don't know if he got more lucky than, you know, speaking prophetically, but just an incredible story about that whole thing with Jay Williams and Shane Battier and Carlos Boozer. What a collection of talent by the Dukies.
Yeah. Speaking of the Dukies, my next one is Toughness by Jay Billis. A terrific. I'm guessing you've read that one, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yep.
It is. It started out as an article. Billis wrote an article for ESPN.com. And it just, I'm sure you remember it, Tony, it wasn't more than 24 hours later. It seemed like every other email you got from another coach, hey, did you see this article? Did you see this? And yeah, and it's really, really good. And so Billis, of course, I think a lot of people forget that started out as an article, but you know, on ESPN.com that he expanded into a book, but it's on a lot of coaches' shelves, so I'm not going to spend a ton of time talking about it, but it just talks about, you know, what it takes to be tough. And there are some tough people out there, obviously. I always told my players, I'm not a physically tough person. If I get into a street fight, I'm probably going to be going down unless I'm Brick Tamblyn running around with a grenade or a trident or something like that. But I feel like I'm a pretty mentally tough person. And that's what toughness is all about. You know, setting a good screen, talking on defense. I'm looking at the article notes here. Get to your teammate first, take a charge. You know, the toughest teams that I've had, Tony, those are the ones that took the most charges, as an example. You know, your body language, show strength in your body language. You know, all these different things. But it is a tremendous, tremendous book. And highly recommend it to everybody. I think it's kind of gotten to the point where some people maybe have forgotten about it. Well, if you've forgotten about it, you need to go to Amazon and pick it up or your local bookstore. But it's an outstanding, outstanding book.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it might be, you know, kind of hit its peak and was overused a little bit by some, and mm-hmm. Now might be the time for it to come back and make an appearance again. But one of the things that really, you know, talk to me in that book was the fact that when you take a look at like Navy SEALs, some of the toughest people on our planet,
yeah.
But it's more about the mental toughness than it is the physical toughness. Those guys look like marathon runners more so than bodybuilders, but the incredible amount of mental toughness they have is just super impressive. But yes, that was a really, really good book as well.
Mm-hmm.
My last book, and this is one of the very, very first books that I read as a young coach, and this is more of the X and O stuff, but was Defense Wins by Bill Hombrick. And I probably read this book 30 years ago, but it is super, super good. Looking to make, you know, my identity as a coach, what did I want to do? Did I want to be a full court press coach, a trapping coach, a zone coach, a man coach? And this one really, really was good. And the great thing about it, it had all kinds of drills in there as it broke down a winning approach to team man-to-man basketball. So it wasn't just, hey, these are the reasons why you should run man-to-man defense. It actually had some diagrams in there as well. And it went over the philosophy and all that good stuff. About 150 some pages long, maybe 170. But anyway, really, really good book that helped to put some of that foundation in there for my belief about basketball and the defense of men.
I had another one like that as well, Tony. I haven't read that one. I'm familiar with that one, but I kind of had the same thing when we were at Briarcliff, and it was myself and Coach Power and Coach Sale. We based especially our half court defense off of, it's called SOS, pressure defense, written by a guy named Bob Kloppenberg. Have you heard of that one before, Tony?
I've heard of him, but I have not heard of the book.
Yeah, again, it's kind of like yours. You know, we're obviously very near the same age, so it's written around that same time, huh?
It's a little older.
Yeah, we won't mention who, but only one person witnessed the Battle of Gettysburg on this podcast. So
I was there. It was great.
It was great. Make its charge. It's awesome. No, SOS pressure defense, really good. And, you know, basically it was switch everything, pressure the basketball, loading to the ball, off the ball, all these different things. So yeah, that's where I base a lot of my defensive philosophies on as well. So, I'm not familiar with yours, but, I might have to check that out. And I gave a new one to you here, buddy. So
yes,
my last one is Why the Best Are the Best by Kevin Eastman. You know, you kind of got to be in the weeds as a basketball nerd to really know who Kevin Eastman is. But if you know who Kevin Eastman is, he is absolutely awesome. I was so excited last fall down at the USA Basketball Clinic that he was speaking there. And so one of the few times in my adult life, I kind of fanboyed out. And I felt like I was like a 12-year-old kid at a card show in 1985. Would you please sign this for me? But I actually did have Kevin Eastman sign my copy of Why the Best Are the Best. Got a chance to have a conversation with him. It's just a terrific, terrific book. And if you've ever seen Kevin Eastman's stuff online, he doesn't do as much speaking as he used to, but he's a great speaker. He believes in talking in bullet points. Again, kind of a Patino-esque type of a thing. Coaching bullet points, speaking bullet points, and different things like that. But he talks about the variables and the qualities and the habits that you need to have to be a great coach. And so, you know, again, Why the Best Are the Best, one of the best coaches books that I've read in the last 10 years or so. I really enjoy it.
Now, he was with Doc when Doc was with the Celtics, right?
Yeah. And then he went with him when he went to the Clippers as well.
Yeah.
So him and Tibbs. It was Doc, Tibbs, and Eastman were the three main coaches on that 2008 Celtics team.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good staff.
Yeah. Coaches have really enjoyed the opening tip newsletter that has been coming out from a pen and a napkin here for almost a year now. Every 2 weeks, on the 1st and the 15th of every month, you're going to get a newsletter with an article, a podcast, a bonus podcast. You're going to get some coaching videos on there. You're going to get some book recommendations, a lot of different things that are coming out here with the opening tip newsletter. It's really driven towards a little bit more of a personal written form of what we do here at A Pen and a Napkin, which of course is to help coaches get better, to hone their craft. And so I use a lot of my own personal experiences. We use other people's personal experiences. We try to go into the lab with coaches. We try to get into the nuts and bolts, a little bit more of a visual compilation of things that we do here at A Pen and a Napkin. So if you haven't subscribed to the opening tip newsletter, you need to do so now. Go to Substack, ruiz.com, find the opening tip newsletter and subscribe to it. Or if you find it on Twitter here, go to it, check it out, subscribe to it. It's going to be a really, really good thing for you to check out. So check out the opening tip newsletter on Substack from A Pen and a Napkin. Well, Tony, you know who perhaps has the best rock and roll staff in the history of the genre.
Here.
Yes, they are, Tony, and it is your turn for trivia, my friend. What do you have for me this week?
Well, I know coming up in TWIB, we're going to be discussing the NBA draft, so I thought I'd do a little NBA draft trivia with you. So here we go. Right. And I hope I'm saying this name correctly, but the last pick of the first round was Jannik Konin Niederheiser from Penn State. Marty, how many players has Penn State had be a first-round draft pick?
Tony, Jannik Konin Niederheiser is the first round pick in the history of Penn State basketball.
This correct?
Yes, and it counts. Hopefully, when he goes, who drafted him again?
Shoot, I just lost it. Give me 1 second. I lost Mr. Jannik Konin Niederheiser.
Yeah.
Oh, round one, draft cast. Let's get the entire thing here. All right, here we go. Jannik Konin Niederheiser was drafted by the... did he trade it by OKC?
It was probably the OKC pick.
He was an OKC pick, and he got traded, and I cannot pick out what the mascot is here for the team that he went to.
You're killing my joke, Tony, because I was going to say, hopefully he doesn't walk into their facility and the first thing they say to him is, Niederheiser, dead! Animal House, sorry. So
Yes.
So, yeah, I was actually watching the, I'm a draft nerd and I love it. It's one of my favorite nights of the year. Now it's two nights a year. I wish they would put it back onto one night, but, so I pretty much watched it from start to finish and I'm such a sycophant that I even watched the second round. So,
Clippers,
that's that where he went. So yeah.
Yeah, well, what did they do to their logo? That's crazy.
Yeah, well, it's a
you have to look it up.
It's a Clipper ship coming at you now. Like you,
right there.
Yeah. So, I tell you what, when Niederheiser walks into the facility instead of Kawhi Leonard saying Niederheiser dead, he'd probably say,
"How about that?"
So, let's talk draft here, Tony. Let's talk draft. Your impressions. Let's just go from the 64,000 foot view or 30,000 foot. Sorry, 30,000. $64,000 question. 30,000 foot view. What were kind of your overall thoughts, my friend?
The thing that stood out to me the most was the emotion. You know, I hadn't seen that much emotion from the guys getting picked, but there were some really, really cool stories. VJ Edgecombe, that was probably what got kicked off with the biggest amount of emotion from what he came from in the Bahamas. I think he said that they lived on a generator for like 7 years without electricity there. That was crazy. And it just kind of worked its way through a lot of them, but just the emotion. Mala Watch from Duke was another one that was just overcome with emotion. And then I know that they called him Colin Coward, but it's Cedric Coward.
Yeah.
That was an incredible story.
Yeah.
Division III, the guy at Eastern Washington played in that league of the D3 school that he was at. He played in that conference, was watching that D3 team play a D1 team. He stood out in that game and then offered him to come to Eastern Washington after his freshman year at that D3 school. He was a backup his sophomore year with Eastern Washington. His junior year, he was a starter, one of their best players, went with them to Washington State, got hurt, I think it was like five games in, maybe less than that, and then just took off and committed to Duke if he hadn't stayed in the draft, and the dude goes number 11. It's just a crazy story. But it was just a really, really good draft from the standpoint with the stories and the emotion were what stood out to me. Now, if you're wanting to know who I thought won the draft, this is going to sound crazy, but I really, really liked what the Utah Jazz did. I really did. Just the picks they got with Walter Clayton Jr. and then Ace Bailey. And I know Ace Bailey needs to get a new agent, needs to get some new representation. But Ace Bailey, in terms of like degree of difficulty of shot, that guy is crazy with the shots that he can make. And Utah is not going to get great free agents that want to come to Utah. I'm not trying to bash Utah. You might have some listeners there. But my point being, Ace Bailey has superstar potential, has all-star potential. And I really like Walter Clayton Jr. I know I might be the only one, but I call him Steph Curry Light. But I like him a lot. And I just thought those two picks were spot on.
I agree with you in that sense. Utah, you know, they've been in the lottery 2 or 3 years, and they've gotten some role players, you know, all things considered. You need to have a guy. And if you're drafting fifth and you feel like this guy has a chance to be a guy, then you got to roll the dice. I mean, you know, and as me personally, would I touch Ace Bailey with a 10-foot pole right now? Not really. I mean, I really wouldn't. But I understand the calculated risk of at the fifth draft pick, we're probably not going to have a chance to get a guy like this at the fifth pick ever. You know, maybe next year, and from what people are saying, this year was a really good draft. Everybody is saying that next year's draft is going to be even better for the talent level. And I've heard that for a while. And Bailey is an opportunity. He's going to be a high ceiling, low floor guy. And I don't think he's going to be anywhere in between, Tony. I think we're going to look 5 years from now and go, we're either going to look at this draft pick at the Jazz and we go, wow. What a gutsy call for them to take a chance on this guy who was kind of a, you know, the things around him and him at this time, it was kind of a mess. Or, boy, that was dumb by the Jazz. I don't think there's going to be, you know, he's doing okay. He's hanging in there. He's a nice player. I think it's going to be one or the other, personally. But I do like Walter Clayton. I thought another team, all things considered, and this was a team that was in the Cooper Flagg sweepstakes as well, that I thought had a really good draft, was the Charlotte Hornets, Tony. They got Con Knipple. In the second round, they drafted Ryan Kalkbrenner. They got another guy. It was Knipple, Kalkbrenner, the Sion James. I'm kind of, you know, that doesn't really move the needle for me, but they had a fourth draft pick, and now I'm looking at the scroll right now and I can't find it. I felt like there was one more guy that they got that I was like, that's a really, really good pick. Oh, they got the McNeely kid from UConn. That's what it was. I was looking, the Suns drafted him and now he's traded to the Hornets. So McNeely, Knipple, and Kalkbrenner. I really like those three guys around Brandon Miller and LaMelo Ball. And I think those are three players that have a chance to really help them in some way, shape, or form as the Hornets are trying to kind of dig their way out of the Michael Jordan ownership years. So I agree with you on the Jazz. I also thought the Hornets had a really good night as well.
I'm not as high on the Hornets as maybe you are. Con Knipple, I think he's the best shooter in the draft. I really wonder if he's going to be able to get that shot off, and I really wonder if he's going to be able to guard. McNeely, you know, I think part of his struggle at UConn this year was staying healthy, but he's another one. It's kind of like, I think they're kind of the same guy.
Yeah.
And so I wonder about that a little bit. I like the Kalkbrenner one because I think Kalkbrenner can be a plug and play guy because they traded Mark Williams. Yeah. And so that was a definite need for them. It was okay. I wasn't as blown away by their draft as maybe I was with Utah. I just think Utah did a nice job, you know, and then again, you take a look at San Antonio and Oklahoma City. Those were other teams that I thought that had good drafts as well.
Yeah.
Teams that I struggled with a little bit, the Wizards, but they're the Wizards. They're going to wizard, if you will. I really struggled with them. And then I don't know who's running the New Orleans Pelicans, but they need to
Joe Dumars.
It's crazy. You go out, you draft Derek Queen goes to Atlanta.
Yeah.
And then you trade Asa Newell for Derek Queen, and you give them a first round draft pick.
Unprotected.
They don't know if I wouldn't have done that deal. And I even had to got Derek Queen. I would have done that deal just to get the unprotected first round draft pick. But you get Derek Queen, who I think is better than Asa Newell. And I think Newell could be a decent player. But New Orleans, I would give an F to. Washington, I'd probably just give a D to.
Mm-hmm. I have a rule on my NBA 2K dynasty, Tony. I never trade away a first round draft pick. I look to accumulate first round draft picks, but I never trade away unless it's like a slam dunk. And I think I'm on year 7 or 8 of my dynasty, and I just sim the games. I don't play the games. I don't have that much time. But I never trade away a first round draft pick. That's strategy number, you know, strategy 101 for me.
Question real quick.
Yeah, you sure can.
Who's the best GM in the NBA?
Well, it'd be hard to argue against Presti right now.
So going back to what you're talking about, Sam Presti is the best NBA GM. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably an assumed thing by most people that know basketball.
It'd be hard to argue against
him. Has he ever traded up the first round draft pick? I mean, you take a look at how he built OKC. If that's the blueprint for today's modern NBA game, yeah. New Orleans just spits in the face and does the exact opposite.
Correct. Yeah. That's such a true statement. Hey, here's how they just won a championship. Let's do the complete opposite and see how it goes. I agree with you, Tony. It is just as Ron Burgundy would say, that's just dumb, you know. And yes. and wholeheartedly agree with you there. I would say the one thing that Con Knipple does have going for him, though, Tony, is he's got the best middle part of any draft prospect coming in a long time. I mean, Tom Chambers looks at that middle part and says, young man, that's a middle part.
And then you take a look. I mean, you've got, what, 4 other brothers?
Yeah.
I don't know that those Knipples, when they're all high school and in college and older, that might be an NBA franchise right there.
Exactly. Yeah, they're gonna. The mom is the all time leading scorer at Wisconsin Green Bay, and they've had a nice program there. So, yeah, there's some good DNA that Con Knipple is coming from. Coaching today is, let's be honest, it's harder than it ever has been, and the demands on us, the things that coaches are asked to do, the lengths that we are supposed to go to be the best coach that we can be, it's becoming more and more difficult. A lot of coaches come into their coaching career and they feel really, really good about their X's and O's knowledge, the technical aspects of the game. And I was very much the same way. That's what I thought coaching was all about, but it's so much more than that. It's about being, especially at the high school level, and you can say the same thing at the college level or even the professional level. It's about being the CEO of your program. Folks, I think I've put together maybe the best thing I've ever done, and that is my third book coming out here this fall, 365 Days of Hoops. A one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO. And what I was able to do was to put together 365 separate concepts of what it takes to become a basketball CEO of your program. This is all divided into basically 10 different areas: book studies, coach studies, X's and O's. So you gotta know what the 2-3 zone defense is all about. Zone sets, defensive tenets, whatever that may be. Culture, building a great culture at your program. Your game day execution. What are you doing on a game day on a daily basis when you're going into competitions? Skill development. Personal development, finding time for you, taking a vacation, handling failure, creating your resume, practice, how to build a great practice, how to become a great practice coach off-season workout ideas, and miscellaneous coaching topics. 365 Days of Hoops has those 10 topics subdivided into 365 different things that you need to do as a basketball coach. At the end of every page, there is space to journal, to write, to X's and O's, everything that you need to do to take that topic, to think about it, and to think about what you are going to do. This is going to be available early this fall. Don't have an exact date yet, but I wanted to put that out there for you coaches so that you know what's coming out here. It's going to be a really, really good thing for you. One thought a day, take 3 to 5 minutes every day to think about it. And by the time you're done with this book, you are going to be really, really be prepared to be a basketball CEO of your program. So keep your eye out on it for 365 Days Hoops, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO, coming this fall from a pen and a napkin. Tony, let's talk a little, a couple of big trades here. Kevin Durant, your thoughts on the Durant trade?
You think it was a move that had to be made by the Rockets? If you take a look at why they lost to Golden State, they didn't have a closer. And obviously Durant is a closer. They didn't have a shooter, you know, and so teams were able to pack it in. Jalen Green, I think you kind of see what Jalen Green's going to be. He's not going to be better than Amen Thompson and some of those really, really good young players that they have. And the other thing too, Houston dealt from a position of strength. You know, you want to get Reed Shepherd more playing time. I think Cam Whitmore is another player that looks like he can play a little bit. Torrey Eason is also a very good player. And so they dealt from a position of strength in this trade. And so I would say that Houston won the trade, so to speak. But at the same time, it wasn't like Phoenix got fleeced. You know, Jalen Green's a solid NBA player. I just don't ever see him being the man. He might be the better at like a second or a third option. Dylan Brooks can guard. There's no doubt about that. I think he and Fred VanVleet really helped to change the culture in Houston to where they are a defensive mindset. You know, and then they got the number 10 pick who they ended up getting with Malawach. And then I really like that pick. I think of the three Duke players, I think he was the most underrated. I like Cooper Flagg, but one thing that jumped out to me, and this was almost my trivia question I was going to ask you, name a Duke player that's won MVP in the NBA. You can't, because they haven't.
Yeah.
And so I don't think Cooper Flagg is going to break that streak, to be honest with you. He's a good player. But one of the things I take a look at this year's draft compared to next year's draft is I think next year's draft has better top-end players. The kid that's going to Kansas, the kid that's going to BYU, one of the Boozer brothers, the kid, I believe, at Tennessee. I think those four are all really good players to keep an eye on. They just don't have the depth. Like, there was probably 10 to 15 guys that didn't get drafted. I was like, wow, I think those guys really have a good shot to make an NBA roster.
This year?
You know, whether it was Mark Sears from Alabama. Yeah, this year's with Mark Sears and some of those guys. But next year's, I just don't think, has the depth.
Yeah, I won't mention a couple of guys from Omaha named Chucky Hepburn and Hunter Salas, who, if you want to know more about their high school story, you can read the last. They were undrafted. They were both undrafted.
I thought Salas did. Let me look at round two here real quick.
No, Hepburn did. He signed a free agent deal with the Sixers, and Chucky signed with, I can't remember who Chucky signed with, but if you'd like to know more about their high school careers, you can look up Kings of Their Court, written by yours truly. So, shameless plug, no shame in any way, shape, or form at all. So, no, I think it will be as much as it can be a win-win deal. Now, overall, did the Suns lose the Durant acquisition? Yes, they gave away too much and did not get enough in return. I really believe that. I didn't think it was a good deal to get him in the first place, personally. Just at the time, what they were giving away, how much they were giving away. You know, again, you get into these situations. Well, we want to get Giannis. Well, but we've got to give away the farm, and there's nothing left to be successful. And that's happened a couple of times. Like the aforementioned 2008 Boston Celtics, they gave away a lot to get Durant and Ray Allen. And they just had just enough to win the championship, but there's There's more stories of teams giving away too much and not getting enough in return and having, and you know what we've talked about the last couple of years, Tony, two stars in depth. That's the formula. And, but I think this, like you said, Tony, I think the Suns did about the best that they could. I do like the Malawach pick. Jalen Green, throw him out there for a year and see what he can do. I was listening to a podcast and a guy was saying he's a Phoenix insider and he's saying Brad Beal, they're either going to buy him out or they're going to find a way to trade him in the offseason. He's not going to be back in Phoenix. So they're trying to course correct here. It's just a matter of what they're going to do. So
so you're seeing 34 shooting guards are too many?
Yeah, 34, 30. If you had 26, that would be about right. But 34, that's too many. So how about the Celtics trades? Kind of breaks my heart personally to see Drew Holiday go to Portland, to see Porzingis go to Atlanta. It's business. They're under the second apron. They got some assets. They got the young guy, Simons, from Portland. Atlanta kind of sneaky moving up into this way wide open East with Dyson Daniels. They got the Jalen Johnson, a Duke kid. He was having a great year last year and then had a season ending injury. If Porzingis can do Porzingis things, they got the Risha kid that they drafted number one last year. Atlanta kind of sneaky moving their way up the ladder if the pieces can kind of fit together. But the Celtics, these were business deals. This was not a basketball deal per se. It was the best basketball deal that they could make in a business situation so that when Jason Tatum comes back a year from now, hopefully they could kind of reset the franchise and have another 3 to 5 year run at the kind of at the end of the prime of Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. That's the way I interpreted it as a Celtics fan, Tony.
I think you're spot on with that. It was financial. They did okay with what they did. Simmons is one of those guys who shoots a lot of threes, which I believe goes in with Joe's philosophy as far as things go. And not just his, I think it's the NBA and you've seen it even make its way into the WNBA as well. Uh-huh. But definitely want to get out of that second apron. I don't know if they're done though, Marty. You take a look at some things. I think they're going to hold on Derek White. I think they're going to hold on to Jaylen Brown as well. But teams had been poking around to see if they could entice them to trade them as well. Luke Kornet, obviously, you're going to have to pay a little bit more money there. And if you want to keep Simmons, you're going to have to, because his contract's up in a year. How well does he fit? Peyton Pritchard's really good. Are they going to try to give him a bigger role? But it'll be interesting to see how Boston puts it together, because, you know, somebody was talking about with OKC, you know, hey, they're going to win multiple championships. And then somebody goes, weren't we all saying that about the Celtics? And now you look at the Celtics and what used to be the Celtics, you're like, yeah, we were. Yeah. And so it will be interesting to see how they try to put that back together again once Tatum's healthy. Brown under contract, obviously. I think Derek White's a really good fit for them, but they've got to decide, you know, with Al Horford, Luke Kornet, and guys like that, how are they going to navigate that? I thought on day two of the draft, they were going to take a kid, is it Renaud or something like that from Stanford? I thought they might take a look at him because that would save them some money. But anyway, they did not. He ended up going to the Kings. Mm-hmm. And I believe, if I remember correctly, they took Noah Penda from France and then traded him to Rouen.
Yeah. When the Celtics put this together, they basically had a 2-year window with all of these finances. They knew that when they got Holiday and Porzingis within a few days of each other. And you can't complain too much. They had a 2-year window and they won a championship in those 2 years. So, you know, the Bill Simmons rule, you know, once your team wins a championship, you have nothing to complain about for 5 years. You can't say anything for 5 years. You can't complain because you got a championship. And so, you know, Tatum's injury disrupted that timetable. Obviously, there would have been at least one move done. And then probably would have been Holiday based on performance. I think Porzingis is obviously the original unicorn, and I think they would have been more apt to keep him. And he was at a lower number than Holiday as well. And so the uniqueness of his abilities and his salary number, for lack of a better way of saying it, just made him more likely to keep if everybody stays healthy, but not everybody's healthy. So then you start thinking a couple of years down the line, and I think that's the direction obviously that's the direction that they're going in. So scrap together a team for 25-26, and let's see what happens. So last thing here, Tony, we've been pretty tight on NBA coverage over the last few weeks here with the tail end of the playoffs and the draft. Dawana Bonner, kind of a controversial. We don't see this a lot in the WNBA, where teams are publicly frustrated, and some of this is kind of they've tried to keep a cap on it, but obviously you could tell there's some frustration by Dawana Bonner especially. But there's some issues here with her being released by the Fever. And you know, Tony, I get, what are kind of your thoughts when, you know, she's the second or third all-time leading scorer in league history, brought her in as a free agent acquisition, wanted to, she came with her coach from Connecticut, Stephanie White, and it just hasn't worked out. It did not work out, and now she's looking to move on.
That was the part that kind of puzzled me a little bit, is the fact that she came with Stephanie White. Obviously, they had a history together at Connecticut, and I think she started like two or three out of the 7-8 games that she was there for, got upset with her role, and basically took her toys and went home and thought about retiring. It's pretty much, you know where she's going to go. She's going to end up in Phoenix because they ended up cutting TJ McConnell's sister the other day with an injury. And anyway, that's where she's going to go, because that's where Alyssa Thomas is. And she's going to be very, very hated in Indiana, no doubt about that, because basically she quit on the team. And then TJ McConnell obviously is very beloved in Indiana with how he played in the finals and is the type of scrappy player that he is. But anyway, this was interesting because you don't see this in the WNBA. It's kind of an NBA or a male pro sport move to take their toys and go home if they don't like what's going on. And Dawana Bonner did it and got her freedom, so to speak. She'll end up in Phoenix. And then I think that the Fever actually end up in the better of it, because they think they get $160,000 of the $200,000 back they were paying her. Mm-hmm. And then they picked up Ari McDonald full time now. And Ari McDonald has played really, really well for them. In fact, in my opinion, has outplayed the Colson girl that had signed with them from Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does have the vibe of, you know, I'm going to take my football and go home type of a thing. She's at the end of her career. And as you have said numerous times, Tony, Father Time is undefeated. And, you know, she just, and probably now, you know, some of these things fit together. Caitlin Clark has missed most of the season for a couple of soft tissue injuries for the Fever. And probably, can you make the argument that perhaps Dawana Bonner is playing better with Caitlin Clark, who is setting her up for some easy shots and opening up the floor for her a little bit more? Is that part of the calculus as well? I don't know. I'm just spitballing Phil Dunphy style here, but that could very well be part of it. So, how different would this be if Caitlin Clark is healthy the entire time? Would be part of my argument for her finding a way to stay, but it's not the way that it went. If you have somebody with that kind of mentality, you probably don't want them in the locker room anyway. So like you said, Tony, it might be addition by subtraction, bringing in McDonald and waiting for Caitlin Clark to come back. And let's just stay, you know, the Fever may have tried to rush that a little bit. You know, again, we talked about Oklahoma City earlier and how they kept this young core together and they slow rolled it. And I don't want to say slow rolled it, but they hired, or gee, I can't talk all of a sudden, Tony. They signed free agents, but they weren't star players at the end of the career. They weren't signing the Russell Westbrooks and the Kevin Durants. They got two role players as free agents that helped them win the championship, and Alex Caruso and Isaiah Hartenstein, the role players that fit around their young core. And those guys understood their role. When you have, you know, the hardest thing to coach in sports is the aging superstar who's not as good as they used to be. And for every Tim Duncan that you have that kind of ages gracefully, you have 100 Dawana Bonners who don't like their new role and have a hard time accepting it. And I think that's part of the story here as well.
Yes. And, you know, she's been in the league just a few years shy of 20 years. And so does she have the right to say how she's going to end it? Possibly. I mean, I don't know if you can begrudge her that, but at the same time, I just think it could have been handled better. I mean, you signed on, they paid you basically as much as they could pay you. And then all of a sudden, a third of the way through the year, approximately, you decide that you're done.
Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't seem right in that way. You know, be a professional, right? If you've been in the league long enough, you need to be a professional. So, Tony, episode 135 in the books. And literally, we talked about books today. Anything to add about literature, reading, books, anything along those lines?
It's a must. If you expect your players to improve, and I said this earlier, you know, physically, watch film, whatever, then you also as a coach have to improve. And it's more than just watching a YouTube video or reading, you know, a paragraph or two. Put some time in. There's some really, really good books out there that are definitely worth the investment.
Mm-hmm. I can't say enough about books and reading books, and you know I'm not going to try and even match what Tony said because he is exactly right. And speaking of books, this is coming out on Monday, June the 30th. Tomorrow, when you folks hear this, you need to get on Amazon.com and you need to pick up a copy of Last of the Cowboys, The Last of the Cowboys, the story of Snow Valley Basketball School. It's going to be available to the public. Dropped off a bunch of copies of it in Waverly. That part of my windshield time, as I was talking about with Tony earlier. Excuse me. So Tony's had a chance to read it, and you know, it's
thumbs up.
Yeah, thumbs up. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. So, folks, I'd really appreciate the support if you would purchase a copy of The Last of the Cowboys. It's a simple read. It's less than 150 pages. It's about 144 pages altogether of text. This one has pictures in it, including a former president of the United States is pictured in the book as well. So, I hope folks choose to go out and get a copy of it. I think they're really going to enjoy it. So, episode 135, favorite coaching books. Hope you folks have enjoyed this podcast. For Tony D. Viss. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.